everybody. I'm glorious, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful just to be here and be sober today, and I want to thank Billy for asking me to come, and I want to thank my friends who took a road trip with me down here. We had quite a ride. I always like to open with, it's called a set-aside prayer. It's kind of Gloria's version of it. But I do like to ask God to set aside anything that I think I know about myself, anything I think I know about recovery, anything I think I know about God, anything I think I know about AA, and to open my heart and mind to a new experience with recovery, with my own story, with AA, and with you all. I was telling John, I said, man, I'm just blank. I really am going to be depending on God to do His thing with me this evening. I'll start off by telling you that I was born in Newport News, Virginia. I am the oldest of four children, and I have three brothers. My oldest brother is in AA in New Jersey. He's been sober about 18 years. And my middle brother is in Texas, and my youngest brother's qualifying. I was raised in a home that there's a lot of alcoholism in their and my parents' families, and they, you know, after I got to AA, I realized what I was dealing with, and just a lot of alcoholism that can be passed down through children of alcoholics. And what I've come to understand is a lot of times the symptoms that we see look like active alcoholics, but it's from being raised in an alcoholic environment. So that's a big part of when I got to AA, that was a big part of my fifth step. And so my dad was one of seven children, my mother was one of three, and I really have her on my mind today because she's having some health issues, and she's been sharing with me a lot about her life, and it's really a heartbreaking thing. And I hope I can get to share some of that with you when I get into recovery. We moved around a lot because my father started out at the shipyard and then ended up going in the insurance business, and we moved to Roanoke when I was eight. We moved to Baltimore when I was 11. We moved back to Roanoke. When I moved to Baltimore, that was really a turning point. My brother and I both have talked about that in our growing up. We were so settled and so happy in Roanoke. And when we moved to Baltimore, that was a whole different culture for us. Those kids were, you know, they were living in the fast lane. You know, I was 11 years old. They were already living in the fast lane. And by the time I got to junior high school, I was introduced to kids that were doing drugs and drinking and skipping school. And being the alcoholic that I am, I thought that was adventurous. And so I was attracted to that. You know, now when I was growing up, my parents would have these parties, and they'd chase each other around the table, and, you know, they were drinking. And I thought, isn't that fun? So, you know, all along, I'm attracted to that kind of lifestyle. And I can remember them talking about some of my uncles, my dad's brothers, who were alcoholics. And I was afraid of that. And I certainly didn't want to be an alcoholic, you know. So here I am where I'm in Baltimore. I'm really feeling not a part of. And I'm trying to become a part of. And so I picked the wrong crowd. At first, you know, I was with a nice little group of kids, and then I wandered off to be with these fast gals. And I took my first drink when I was in the 10th grade. And I took that first drink because my boyfriend broke up with me, and his best friend, who was a good friend of mine, got killed a week later, got hit by a truck. And my friends took me out to cheer me up, and I took a drink. You know, they said, here, Gloria, if you'll take this, and he handed me a can of Country Club Malt Lager. Now, I don't know if y'all are familiar with that. It used to be like a two-for-one thing drink. They're little cans, little. Packed a powerful punch, though. And what I remember of, it's still a vivid memory in my mind's eye, is that I drank and got drunk. I went into a blackout. I must have passed out because I came to in somebody's home on their sofa with my friends, you know, trying to cheer me up and wake me up. And I thought, this is fun. This is what I want to do. But the biggest memory I have of taking that drink, because I was in so much emotional pain, is that it took the pain away. And I said, I want to do this every opportunity I get from now on. I don't ever want to have to feel that pain again. And so that's what I did. I started going out with the guys to drink, because none of the girls didn't drink like I wanted to. And my mother always thought I just had a lot of dates. But they were all just buddies. And then I started climbing out of my window in my bedroom to go join the fast group and get drunk. And I know that my mother didn't know what she was dealing with. I can still remember how my behavior was so unacceptable. We would get into these yelling matches, and my mother was a screamer and a yeller. She wasn't a warm, fuzzy kind of person, and so, you know, I didn't get a lot of accolades or all that nurturing that some kids get. Now, that's not why I'm an alcoholic. I just want you to know that. But it certainly did affect my philosophy and my behavior. So, but I would get so outdone with her, and she would cry, and, you know, and I'd go off with my resentment. My dad wasn't around a lot because he was busy working, and I blamed her for everything that was going on with me. And so we moved back to Roanoke when I was going into my senior year in high school. Now, I knew that this was the answer. This was my geographic cure, my very first geographic cure. And I come back to Roanoke, and there's kids that I know, and I go to a different high school than what I wanted to, but it was a good year for me. Now, here is evidence that talks in the big book, you know, about we can stop for periods of time on our own willpower. And I thought, well, you know, I didn't make a conscious effort not to drink. My thinking was I wanted to not be such a bad actress. You know, I wanted to quit doing the things I was doing. Not necessarily stop drinking. But I didn't drink there for about, I don't know, 6 months, 8 months, I don't know. But I smoked, and they called me the Baltimore bombshell when I got to Roanoke, because, you know, I had the big hair and the stiff hair. You know, you sprayed it down with a can of hairspray in the morning, and I smoked cigarettes, and they thought that was just awful. These little Roanoke Virginians just thought that was just awful. And I thought, if you only knew, you don't know the half of it. So I got through my senior year successfully, but I began to become irritable, restless, and discontent. And I didn't know this is because I'm an alcoholic. I just thought, these people are boring. Let me find some people that are fun. And, of course, I looked around, and I found a couple of guys again. I had the reputation. Anyway, I hooked up with some guys that liked to drink and started drinking again. Now, the big memory that I have as I look back is that I had set up a date with this guy. I broke that date to accept a date with another fellow who my best friend had a crush on. That's the kind of person I was. And I went to the Colonial Hills Club. It was a dance hall. You took your own beer, whatever you were going to drink, you know, or you snuck it in. And they had live music. This is back in the good old days, you know, 1963. Okay, so here I am. This guy's name is Laird Manlove. That ought to tell you something. Yes, he was boring. Anyway, I was standing up on a chair watching the band, and this fellow comes over. And he looks up at me, and he says, "Hey, baby, how about dancing?" Well, I didn't know who he was, but that didn't matter. And I danced with him the rest of the night. And that date there. Well, the funny thing is, when I walked in the door of the Colonial Hills Club, the first guy I had the date with was standing there at the door. And, of course, I'd lied to him. So here I am, you know, just caught up in my lies and all about drinking. That's all I was interested in, having a good time. I didn't care about how you felt or how I was hurting your feelings, as long as I was getting done what I need to get done. So Laird took me home, and he said the most interesting thing to me. He said, "You know, Gloria, you know that story, the song, The Lemon Tree? It says the fruit is so beautiful. The flower of the lemon tree is so beautiful. When you bite into the fruit, it is so bitter." He said, "That is you." I never forgot that. He was telling the truth. But of course, you know, being the alcoholic that I am, I quickly pushed that aside. And I began to date this fellow that I had met at the Colonial Hills Club. And he took me to a local beer joint for our first date. And when he took me home, he said, "I don't know if I can afford to date you because you drink me under the table." And I did for a very long time. Now, he was already a raging alcoholic. And my mother found out about this through mutual friends. And my parents were horrified for me to date this fella. And I didn't care. You know, I went off to Longwood College. He was a senior at Tech, and he was in a fraternity. And, man, I thought I had arrived because I got to be in that party scene with the fraternity parties. And every weekend we were somewhere drinking and getting drunk. Now, I go back so far, y'all. This is when we had house mothers, and men weren't allowed on the dorms, and you had to sign in and sign out, and they checked you when you came in. You had to stand in the hall, and the house mother went down and smelled your breath. And so we had to either eat garlic or, you know, chew a lot of gum and eat peppermint candy, and I never did get caught for drinking. You know, maybe if I had, it would have saved me. I don't know. I never got caught that way. But one night, a friend of mine on the dorm, she was having some trouble with her boyfriend at the Sigma Chi house, and she wanted me to help her sneak out because she'd heard I knew how to sneak out of a dorm. And so I said, "Well, I just don't think that's a good idea." And she, you know, finally I just said, "Okay." So I help her to sneak out, and I look up. We're getting ready to, she's trying to get me to get in the car with her. And she said, "Oh, look." And then we look up at the window, like the third story, and there is student government meeting, looking at us, getting in the car. And so they come and jump in their cars, and we had a car chase in Farmville. So they got me in front of Stu Goo, and I just lied. I was the best liar. And, you know, I don't need much practice today. I can fall back into that easily. But I was a pretty good liar, and I thought of a really good story about this other girl. They did campus me for 3 weeks. And I didn't think my parents would find out, but they did. They wrote a letter to my parents. And that was the beginning of the end for me. So I finished up that freshman year on academic probation, and I just knew where I was heading. But I ended up that summer, again, you know, still seeing this guy that I had met at the Colonial Hills Club, and also dating one other guy. And I ended up pregnant by the first man. And so we were going to get married. We went and told my parents, and they were horrified. Now, this is back, like I say, in the 60s. This just didn't happen. It was not acceptable. You know, you wore the big scarlet S, and that's how you felt, the scarlet letter, because you were an outcast. So my parents told me what I had to tell people. And so, you know, it talks about how our dishonesty and how we tell ourselves, we convince ourselves through self-justification about what's really going on and what isn't. This is a good example of that because I told that story so many times about the fact that my parents were moving again, so we decided we'd get married, and I got pregnant on our honeymoon. And that, I told that so many times I'd about come to believe it. And this is, I share this because later on in my story it becomes significant, but the other guy that I was dating, he was at Hampton, Sydney, which was right there near Longwood, and he had big plans for us and how we were going to go back to school the next year, and I was going to be pinned to him. And so he'd gone off to the Coast Guard for the summer, and he comes back and calls me, and my mother said, well, she's married. And he's shocked, you know. So, here I am. I'm married. I'm having the first child. I did not drink those 9 months. I don't know how. I don't know why. I just didn't drink. But as soon as I had that child, that's the first thing I wanted was a drink. And once I picked that drink up, there was no telling how much I was going to drink or what I was going to do when I did drink. My behavior was totally unpredictable. Sometimes I could drink all night and not get drunk. Sometimes I'd get drunk after one or two. I never knew. The blackouts, they started early, like I said, on the very first drink. When I got 12-stepped, the man told me that blackouts was a symptom of late stages of alcoholism. So, you know, there I am. So I ended up with 3 children out of that marriage. And we had a rough time, both of us being alcoholics. And for a time, he would take care of me when I drank, and then it would reverse. And then it got to the point where his alcoholism was spiraling down fast, and he became unemployable. He'd been the vice president of a mortgage company, and then he'd been a stockbroker, and then he became unemployable. And I had to go to work, and it was the biggest resentment I had that whole marriage. I hated him for making me have to go to work and leave my kids and not be the sweet little housewife that I had been. I had a great life, and I could drink and get by with it, and, you know, we'd get together sometimes in the afternoons in our backyard and start having drinks about 4 o'clock. I played bridge, and we drank when we played bridge. I mean, you know, whatever I did, I drank. It didn't matter. And we belonged to the country club, and and I drank there, too. Now, I'll give you, I'm going to share a little story about that. This is how we were. We'd go to these formal gigs, and he'd be in his tux, and I'd be in my long dress, and we'd get drunk, and we'd start fighting. Fun pretty. And one night, and I was one of those, when we got in an argument, it was, stop the car, I'm getting out. And wherever he stopped, I got out and walked wherever I wanted to go, you know, wherever that was. Half time I didn't know. So here we are. We are leaving the country club. And it's in an area where there's a lot of nice homes. And we're fighting, and I said, stop the car. I got out. And I went and hid behind these bushes in front of this house. And he's driving around calling my name. And finally he drives off. And then the police drive up. Well, this is the way I think as an alcoholic. I come out from behind those bushes like it was a normal thing to do in my long formal dress. And I go over to this policeman and I stick out my hand and introduce myself. I didn't have a problem with an ego, did I? And I said, do you know me? I sell real estate. And a big whoop. And so he took me home, never said one thing to me about my drinking. And this happened to me all the time. I should have been in jail many times. I drove drunk so much. I have horrible memories of driving home, especially from the lake, on a hot summer day like today, so drunk I could not see straight with three children in the back seat of the car. I don't know how I survived or they survived. So that marriage ended, and that's another long story. I just won't go into that today. But so I became a bar drinker. And he and I both drank in the same bar. And I did not like the women he was hanging out with. I just thought they were floozies. And so one night in the parking lot, I just accosted them. And they didn't like it, of course. And they told me where I could go. And so that made me mad. And they got in the car, so I followed them to the house. Now, I left him. Left him with the house, took the kids. And so I climb in the basement window and go up into the kitchen and fix myself a drink. Now, I've taken on most of the furniture, you have to understand. And he and this girl are in the living room making out on the floor. I made a lot of noise making that drink. I pulled up a chair and sat down. Crossed my legs, clinked my ice. They just didn't even come up for air. And I said, well, what am I going to do? So, I made another drink. And by the time I was getting back into the living room, they were heading up the steps to the bedroom. So I started to follow them. And something stopped me. And probably a good thing, because one of us had probably committed murder that night. So I went on home and called my husband, we weren't exes yet, and told him what I'd done. He never believed it. He never believed it. Now, he also would get really drunk, and I would try to straighten him out, not wanting to drive or whatever. And so he started getting physical with me. I don't blame him for that today. I'd had a huge resentment for it when I got sober. But I antagonized the situation. I was famous for throwing food in his face, throwing drinks at him. You know, he never knew what to expect from me. That's the kind of crazy lunatic I was. I was a bad alcoholic. There's no question, you know, when I got to step two, it says in the 12 and 12, who cares to admit they're mentally ill? I had not a problem with that. My biggest fear, well, I had two really big fears when I was drinking. One, that I was going to end up in an insane asylum. I just knew that's where I was going to end up. A lot of mental illness in my family, a lot of suicides. And the other fear was that I was going to end up in jail. Thank God that hasn't happened yet. So here I am in 1977. I'm really desperate and don't know really what's going on. I've been through counseling after leaving my husband with my minister, who was getting his master's in therapy, and asked me if he could use me as his guinea pig. So we taped all of our sessions. And this is the kind of con that I was. He told me that I really had my head on straight and that I was going to be just fine. And after I got sober, he was on my amends list, and I called him and told him I was an alcoholic. And he was shocked. You know, I could be that, the character the big book talks about. You know, we put on the show, we're the actor or actress, and I could play whatever part I needed to play with whatever crowd I was with. So I had one crowd of friends that were probably, quote, normal people. They weren't alcoholics. And then I had my drinking buddies. So when I got to AA, all of my, quote, normal friends just were shocked. Oh, they just didn't believe I was an alcoholic. And that would have been a good rationalization for me not to get sober. Well, I ended up, I tried everything that year, everything. I went to the Christian Woman's Club. Well, I tried to commit suicide twice. So a friend of mine found out, and she said, well, I need to be get saved. I said, okay, that's probably true. But so she took me to the Christian Woman's Club to get me saved. And there was a girl talking, a woman named Gloria Jean, which is my name. And she had had a story much like mine. She didn't say she was an alcoholic. She got saved. And she was a country singer, and she'd cut an album. I bought the album, bought my wine, went home, played the record, cried and drank. Because it was such a sad story. Then, after that, I went to a Sunday school class. I was trying everything. I'd already read the self-help books. I've been the rounds of the doctors. They all gave me Valium and Librium and several other medicines. Fortunately, I didn't like that. I didn't like what it did to me because when I took Valium, I was out. You don't function. I don't. When I take drugs, I don't function. I am a moving and grooving alcoholic. You know? So I'd rather get drunk. So here I am now. Okay, what's the next move? The next move is to go, I'll go to, back to church. So I take my kids, we go back to church. And in that church, in that Sunday school class, was a man named Bud who'd been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 27 years. And he talked about his alcoholism. He talked about being a drunk. He handed out the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and said to those people, and I thought I was one of those people, he said, well, if you're not an alcoholic, you just take the word alcohol out of the first step, and these will work for you too. So I went home and pinned those on my bulletin board and got up and read them every day, and I thought that was working the steps. But I was fascinated with this man. And so I would hang out after Sunday school and talk to him. And I was selling real estate at the time, so he would get me to go show him houses. Well, I thought he wanted to buy something. He was just 12-stepping me. I can look back and see that today. And it was I'm so grateful for that experience. So they found out that my ex was an alcoholic, so they sent me to Al-Anon. So here I am in the early part of 78. I'm going to some Al-Anon meetings. I'm going to the Christian Woman's Club. I'm going to their Bible studies. And I'm still getting drunk every night. And I don't understand what's going on. What is wrong with me? And I said, well, it's these men. That's the problem. So I asked God if he would remove that from me. And bam, he did. You know, I didn't have a desire to go to the bar and pick up men anymore. That was my agenda every night. And then I really found out about my alcoholism because I drank all the time. And I would go into these where I would lose days. And here I have three children. And I would come out of this blackout and I wouldn't know, well, how are they being taken care of? You know, when I drank in the bars, I would be petrified that the house would burn down or they would get killed. And I just pick up another drink. I couldn't do anything about it. The big book says that we have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we can't live up to them. And that was me. I knew I was a bad actress, and I didn't know that there was any hope for me. And on that last drunk, that's where I was. I had been taken to an AA meeting because my ex-husband had me get Bud to come and 12-step him. And he did it in my living room. And in the middle of that 12-step, the ex-husband says, well, she's the alcoholic, not me. So Bud got me to an AA meeting. Now, I heard that the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. And I said, well, if I ever get that bad, I know where to call. But I didn't click. I didn't feel like I belonged. I wasn't home, you know. And I didn't know. We were reading in the big book at my home group. And we were on the part more about alcoholism. last night. And we were talking about just this kind of drinking. The Fred, you know, Fred with that kept going back out, the jaywalker. And yes, that was me. I wasn't really trying not to be an alcoholic. I just didn't understand the disease that I have and that it's powerful and that I have no control over it. So Bud said to me, just don't drink. Just don't drink. I thought, piece of cake. That was on a Friday. On Monday, I was boiled as an owl and not understanding how I got there. How did this happen again? And by Saturday, I started drinking in the morning. And I was going to a cocktail party that night where my husband was going to be. And I said, I can't drink there because he thinks I'm an alcoholic. So I'll just drink, you know, during the day. And, of course, I don't know about the rest of y'all, but I always had to have a couple of drinks before I went somewhere. You know, got to get loosened up. And I get to this party, and they come over to me about an hour later and say, he's not coming, you can drink. Now, in the meantime, we'd been in the kitchen making fun of this man who had 12-stepped me. And I'm making fun of him, saying, well, he thinks I'm an alcoholic. You know, what is so interesting to me is how screwed up my perspective was and how I saw this man as trying to hurt me and calling me an alcoholic, you know. And all he was trying to do is help me. And I have to remember that sometimes in AA when I'm trying to carry the message. We're just very disturbed, twisted people. At least I am. So, and the reason I told you that story about the man who went to the Coast Guard is because that night, all of a sudden, it was like I couldn't get drunk in my mind. My mind's clear as a bell. I back up and sit down on the sofa. And he comes over to me. And he says, I want to know, why did you marry that man and not me? Now, this is 20-some years later, you know. And I said, well, if you really want to know the truth, and it's the first time I told the truth about that story, I said, I was pregnant. And he said, that's what I thought. That was the beginning of the end for me. I did not know that this was my last drink. Just that, stating that honestly, opened the door for me. You know, I believe it was the grace of God. And I was catapulted, you know, into sobriety within 24 hours. I went home that night and had a horrible, horrible night struggling. And ended up rolling out of the bed and seeing myself in the mirror and being disgusted. And I got on my knees and I said, God, please help me because I can't live like this anymore. I did not know that I was not going to drink again. My last drink was on December the 4th, 1978. And I still can't believe it. I cannot believe it. I have to pinch myself. It is a wonderful way of life. Now, when I came into AA, I've described a pretty crazy, insane woman to you. And the family that I came from was also, you know, we were all screwed up. I had no idea what I had in store for me in working these 12 steps. But that man that 12-stepped me, he and his wife, who's a black belt, Al-Anon, assigned themselves to me as my sponsors. And I am so grateful for that today. Now, I know people take people through the book today. That's not how I was sponsored. That's not how we did it 30-some years ago. I was told to read the big book. That's what it says in Working with Others. That's what it says in Chapter to the Employer. Give this book to your new man. If he looks like he's interested in sobriety, have him or her read it and then see if they are interested in the program. And that's what Bud said to me. You read this book. You highlight what you connect with and keep an open mind about the rest. He said, if you're sober long enough, then you will come to understand and agree with everything in that book. That's been true. Now, so then he said, okay, where are you with the book? Well, I've read it. Yeah, I'm ready. Well, when I had that moment of truth, I have to go back a little bit and let you know, I had it in his kitchen with him and his wife, because I ended up going to that Sunday school class that Sunday morning and fell apart, just sobbing, and said, my whole life's falling apart and I don't know what's wrong. So they invited me to their home, and the first thing Bud asked me is, when did you have your last drink? And I lied. And he asked me that 3 times, and finally he said, I'm going to ask you one more time. And I said, well, if you really want to know the truth, then I'll tell you. And I did. And he got up and left the room. And he left me so I could have my moment of truth. Because I saw in my mind's eye, I had this vision. And his wife standing there, she said, what do you see? And I said, well, I see that I'm an alcoholic. And I see that the 12 steps are what I've been looking for in church, in counseling, in, you know, everything I've tried. That's what I've been looking for. And she took me through the first 3 steps that day. And then when I finished reading the book, Bud took me through the first 3 steps, just like it's outlined in the book. What's so interesting is that when I got sober, you didn't hear much about those taking the 3rd step with another person. I was fascinated with that. And he said, you'll find people don't even know that it's in the book. And so I started going around, and, you know, that's what I would talk about in the meetings. And people were really, they were in awe. They didn't know it was in the book. And, and the women I started out sponsoring, and they were fascinated with that too. And they were grabbing people, you know, taking them through the first 3 steps. Because what was passed on to me is get them through the steps as fast as you can, and especially those first 3 steps, because they'll come under the care of God in a new way. Because I happen to believe that God's always been alive and well in my life, but I wouldn't let him in. Yet he was there waiting. Now, I had a lot of work to do, and when I did my first inventory and did that 5th step, Bud and his wife said to me, you know, God decided somebody in your family had to get well. And he was right. I had the 3 children. My daughter, my youngest daughter was 5. My middle daughter was 10. And my oldest daughter was 13 when I got sober. I have a lot of amends to make to them. And, you know, it says in the book that there's some things that we can't live a lifetime and make amends for. And that's the way I feel about my children. But the other relationships that I had, like with my mother, I had a deep, deep resentment for her and for my ex-husband. And I was told that I needed to pray for her every day and read this story, Freedom from Bondage. I don't hear that much today in AA either. We talked about that story all the time because it's got the resentment prayer in it. I was told also to get index cards and put every prayer in the big book in 12 and 12 on index cards and carry them with me so that I could then begin to be aware of my thinking and my attitudes in working step 6 and 7. I can't change me. Only God can. And he will if I will work with him. And this is, to me, is how I work with him, is being aware of what needs to change. Now, I can ask him to change those things specifically, but that's God's business. How he changes me is his business. And he may have something else in mind that usually he does. But these relationships were very difficult, and so when I got to step 8, my sponsor had me do something I haven't heard much today about, but I had to make a list of every significant woman in my life and do an inventory on each one, on those relationships. And then I had to do the same thing with men. That was amazing. In the step 8 and the 12 and 12, it says that their defective relationship with others is the immediate cause of their woes, including our alcoholism. And it goes on to talk about how no field of investigation can yield us more rewards than this area. And I just happen to believe in my experience that step 8 is the meat of the program. Because that's when I'm really going to get down to looking at the way I have treated people, just not in the past, but also today. And to begin to really be aware of my attitudes, my facial expressions. My daughter used to say, well, Mom, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. And she said to me one day, are you mad? And I said, no. Well, then you need to tell your face about it. Now, she was in Alateen. This was a fortunate thing. All three of my girls did end up in Alateen. But my youngest daughter started running away from home and got into drugs and alcohol when she was 12 years old. And it threw me into Al-Anon, and thank God for that, because through that program in AA, it saved my life, really. My daughter just picked up a 3-year chip a week ago. She ended up in jail, in drug court, lost her kids, lost everything 3 years ago. So fortunately for me in having this program, I was able to maintain my sanity. I had to make decisions like she had a 2-year-old son, and she was in a halfway house, and she was acting out. And they called me and said, you're going to have to come and get your grandson. And I'd done a lot of work here praying, and I kept him before while she'd been in jail. And my sponsor had said, if you keep enabling her, if she's not going to make it. Now, this wasn't something that happened in my head, but I found these words coming out of my mouth. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to help you. And I'm shocked, you know. And they said, you mean you want us to call social services? I said, look, that's what you have to do. But I'm not going to be able to help you. Fortunately, none of that happened. It worked out. You see, it was all about me and what I have to do as a recovering alcoholic to stop behaviors that are not only harming me, but are harming other people. I married a man that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 5 years sober, and he was 2 years sober, and I thought, well, I thought we were sober, folks. We weren't sober. We were crazy. You know, Keith Lewis says, boy meets girl on AA campus, it's like two chicks without a dog. Now, that's the picture. So, you know, I didn't know how to have a marriage. I knew how to do a lot of things, but I didn't know how to have a marriage. And he had a lot of anger problems, and I had a lot of fear problems, and so we were a mess. You know, there were times when I was taught, if I'm in the middle, if something gets started, and he's mad or I'm mad or whatever, to walk away. Go to the phone. Call my sponsor. Go outside. You know, go to a meeting. And there were many times when, I'd go to the phone and call someone, they'd come pick me up and take me to a meeting. But I had to begin to look at me. And that's why I think this step 8 is so important. Because I blamed everybody and everything for so long. And I had to begin to see that it was my reactions that were the problem. And one time he was getting in my daughter's face. She was about 14. She was getting ready to run off again. And then he got in my face and I said, you're not going to bully me with your anger. I'm shocked, you know, that I'm having this response. And I just kept saying that quietly. And he said, he sat down, and something came over him, and he said, well, what can I do? And it was the opening up of communication for us, because that's what I found has been my big problem. You know, I've told you that my mother was a screamer and a yeller. It took me 25 years in this program to finally learn how to deal with my mother. And I don't need to get into her story, but she does have... Like, I will just tell you this. She told me on the phone today. She said, my father was so mean. And she said the police were there almost every weekend. And she said, I was afraid of him, and I never knew what he was going to do next. And so, you know, when you learn those kinds of things, when I learn them, it gives me understanding. And one, our four watchwords are patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. I have to have those in order to have a relationship with you. And I have to begin to understand me in order to understand you. I have to realize what my defects of character are and realize, hey, it's like Dale Wilson says, we're brothers in our defects, not in our assets, you know. And I do believe that. Today I really love my mother. And she has a problem in communicating, getting along with others. And she has run everybody out of her life. She's in Florida. But she's got some health issues now. And I am so grateful to God for having given me this attitude of love towards my mother and compassion. And I've told my brothers, I said, you know, she doesn't talk to me like that anymore. I said, I've learned a way of communicating with her. There's a presence there, and I don't claim it's me, that takes care of this anymore. I'm not trying to get back at her. I'm not argumentative. You know, I'm the one that's changed. My ex-husband got cancer. I got acute myelogenous leukemia in September of 99. I went back to nursing school in 91, graduated in 94 with the BSN, and I ended up working on this cancer unit, and I admitted him to our services and took part in the end of his life. And he said to me, what happened to us, Gloria? We had it all. And I stood there thinking, where is that woman he's talking about? I don't know who she is. But I do love him. You know, I had love for him. And he asked me if I would pray for him. And I sat on the bedside, held his hand, and prayed for him. And I found him in cardiac arrest. And it was only three of us nurses working on the floor, so two of them had to do the CPR, and I had to call the family. That meant my kids. That meant his girlfriend. And I was able to do that through the grace of God in this program. And he died 2 weeks later. They finally took him off the ventilator. My father died in June that year. And I drove from Roanoke to Florida. I'd work 56 hours, and then I would drive 12 hours down there to be with him. I did that once a month for 6 months. And I was present when he died. That was a great gift. Because my father had written me a letter when I was graduating from nursing school. And he said to me, you know, Gloria, I know that I wasn't there for you when you were growing up. And I know it was my loss. But he said, what I know is that you have forgiven me. And I had. Then my husband got shot in October of 99. And it talks in the 11th step, you know, we thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. And I that's how I got through that. I prayed and I watched this woman do things I never thought she was capable of doing. And I sat at his bedside. He was unconscious for a long time, and they really thought he was going to die. But I stayed by his side. I missed 2 months from work. I depended on God for everything. My every breath, you know, could not worry about our finances. I knew I had to be there for him. That changed our whole relationship, too. When he was shocked, you know, that I was that loyal and that loved him that much. But then he got cancer a year later. And we learned to live one day at a time. We had both grown a lot in AA, and our relationship was a very sweet relationship. We loved each other very much, and we shared a lot together, from carrying the AA message to our most intimate problems. We could help each other. I never thought that would happen. But when he died, he told me, he said, I want you there holding my hand when I die. And he had been unconscious for about 18 hours. And two of my daughters were with me. One had gone upstairs and gone to bed, and the other one was there in the room. We had a hospital bed in the den. I was on the sofa, and Catherine was there, and she woke me up and said, Bill's trying to get your attention. And I went to his bedside, and he was just making guttural noises. He couldn't really talk at that point. You know, one thing he had said to me during this process, because dying, you don't just die. It is a process, like being born. He said, I feel like my spirit's getting bigger and my body's shrinking. And he said, I think that's the way it's supposed to be. So he says to me, I love you. He did not want to die. And I knew he had to go. And it was very hard. But I took his hand and I said, Bill, I love you too. But it's time for you to go. And I said, you take my love with you. And I'll keep your love for me in my heart. And I went into this almost a trance. I asked my daughter to give me a Bible, and I read the 23rd Psalm because it wouldn't come to my head. And I went into like a trance, and I could see, I was like in a tunnel. I could see this light, and I described it to him. And I said, there's people there waiting for you. And I can't tell you what all I said, but my daughter could tell you every word, so she was in the hall. And he let out a yell, and he was gone. That was a very moving experience. But let me tell you, I had never dealt with grief like that, drunk or sober. But I got to experience it. And you know, what I've learned about Alcoholics Anonymous is that life is worth every pain that I have to experience. Because that's living. That makes me know I am alive. To feel what I feel. And let it happen, and to invite God in, to trust Him, and know that I'm going to be okay. He is in charge, and that's what I did. I had to have both of my knees replaced after he died, and the doctors were really concerned about me. They sent me to a psychiatrist because here I am, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I hadn't had a drink. I think it had been 27 years at that point. And I'm going to have this knee surgery, and they have to give me a lot of narcotics. This is supposed to be the most painful surgery. And here I've just lost my husband. And there were days when I wanted to die. I wanted to go be with him. And I said to God, you know, this is the deal. I said, I know if I killed myself, then I wouldn't be able to find Bill. That'd be the heck of it. You know, I'd be searching all over eternity looking for Bill, not be able to find him and think, damn, why did I kill myself? But I had the knees done. The psychiatrist told me, he interviewed me, and he said, you're doing all the right things. You stick with Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't need me. And that was another blessing, because I'd been afraid of psychiatrists all my life, and afraid to go to them. Knew they would find me, deem me insane. Today, I'm in a job as a home health nurse. I am the partners and care nurse for Carilion, which means I help people to transition to hospice at the end of life, and I do a lot of end-of-the-life counseling with people. It's unbelievable to me to be in that position. It's very treasured. I have three daughters that are doing very well with their lives. My oldest daughter's having her issues, but she's been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 27 years. Isn't that amazing? She came in when I got married to Bill, and she was 18 years old. And my youngest daughter's got 3 years. My middle daughter ended up going to Al-Anon because she married a raging ex-con alcoholic who tried to kill her. And that's a whole other story I don't have time for. But we took her in and her child, and she went to Al-Anon, got herself straightened out. And ended up meeting a fine fellow, and they've been married 20 years now. So, you know, the program has just been awesome in our lives. And you can see how just one person getting sober, I mean, it gives me chills. One person getting sober, look what it did for my family. It is awesome. I can never repay that. I never can. I do a lot of 12-step work, and I love alcoholics, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last thing that I've just been so honored about is a few weeks ago, I got a letter from the GSO asking me if I'd be one of the speakers at the International. And so I'm going to participate on a panel talking about unity, service, and recovery, which I have a passion for, and some people just get tired of me talking about it. But I want AA to survive. I want it to be there for my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren, because it can do for them what it's done for me. Thank you so much for being a good audience and listening to me. And I just appreciate y'all. Love you. Thank you.